Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, we have a very special guest with us, Katie Francisco. Her name might sound a little bit familiar to some listeners, as her brother Matt was a special guest on our show in season one. Like her brother, Katie was born from donor conception and has been an advocate for donor-conceived community by sharing her story and supporting restorative reproductive medicine. Katie served 6 years as the operations manager for CanaVox, the marriage and family project of the Witherspoon Institute, and 3 years for the International Institute for Restorative Reproductive Medicine as secretariat. Katie met her husband while living in New Jersey and now supports him full-time as well as raising their son, a spunky 18-month-old. Katie, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your personal story with us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I also want to thank you for being a financial supporter of the work that we do at the Center for Bioethics and Culture. It's always nice to have a donor on the show too. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So after listening to your brother's story, which aired probably a couple of years ago now, I know very little about you and how your story and how you found out you were donor conceived. Could you tell the listeners how you found out you were donor conceived and kind of all of the motions that came with that?
Yeah. So Matt, my brother, had a little bit of a different story because he found out about 6 months before I did. He had already asked specifically asked how he was conceived because of various notions that he had and he was experiencing. And so by the time that I found out, my mom and my dad, who raised me, sat me down at Thanksgiving. I was the only kid home at this point. And they said, you know, Bill said, I'm not your biological father. We struggled to have children, yada, yada. And I was totally shocked. You know, this came out of left field. I'd had weird things happen, but not like my brother. And I had always looked like my mom. People commented about that. So for me, it wasn't as much of an identity issue. Mm-hmm. I did feel there were some disconnects and signs. You know, my brother and sister-in-law call them flashbulb memories, where it's like a light goes off now that we look back. Mm. And one of those, I shared this in an article I wrote on the Witherspoon Institute's public discourse, their online journal. But I was sitting in the car with my dad, who raised me when I was, I don't know, 16 or 15. And I was trying to do the math of how much Cherokee I was by blood. And his response was just very odd because he wouldn't affirm my genetics in talking.
And so is he Cherokee?
He's Cherokee. Okay. Yeah. He's like a 16th or an 8th Cherokee or something. And so I was saying, oh, so I'm, you know, a 16th or a 32nd Cherokee, mm-hmm. because you're this, and he just wouldn't affirm me. And it was very strange. And there are times looking back that now I know, okay, he was uncomfortable in that moment because he knew that I wasn't his child. Wow. And so he didn't actually know if I was Cherokee or not, you know?
Right.
So they told me, I was a senior. Yeah. I was a senior in college.
Oh, wow. So quite a bit later in your life.
Yeah, it was a week before my 22nd birthday.
Wow.
And I just left. I like went outside and cried. And then I went to a friend's house. I called my brother. And I went to a friend's house in Ocala, which is 45 minutes from Gainesville, where I was in school. And I don't think I stayed the night, but I just had to be with a good friend, you know, and they didn't quite understand. Her mom said, oh, you are so loved. That's the first thing she said. You know, they wanted you so much, but I didn't feel that. I know that's true, but I didn't feel that that was the motivation, or it just seemed like that wasn't my reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Was that I was very loved. You know, it's not loving to lie to your child for 20 years. And, you know, my my mom has never said she regrets it because she has us now.
Right.
And so I think working through that with her, that I think we've had to kind of come to terms with, yes, you struggled with infertility. That's very painful. And I've reassured her, I understand you didn't have good counsel on this. You know, they asked a pastor if it was okay. And he said, yes. Mm. And the doctors encouraged it. So, you know, I think something that I talk to friends about who struggle with similar things, you know, I have a friend from IVF and we're both Catholic and we know the ramifications of IVF with leftover embryos and mm-hmm. what it does to a woman's body to go through those kind of hormone treatments. And she's, you know, been uncomfortable with her conception, but she can't, it's not like she can take it back or something.
Right.
It's not like she hates her parents. But we've kind of talked about how, like, our parents also have a story in this. And so in sharing our own story, we have to have compassion and understand that, like, her parents were also malinformed and malformed in this. And I think that's an important angle when you're approaching this topic. And that's something I've found. I've given various talks on donor conception. That's really been my advocacy work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fewer than 10 or 10 at this point. It's not a lot, but I think throughout, you know, as I went along giving presentations to social workers and governments and various places, mm-hmm. I've learned that to really share the full picture, you do kind of have to give compassion to the people that made those decisions and also share how much it negatively affected me.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, absolutely. After my first talk, I had a friend attend and she said, Katie, try not to be so put together. That was her advice to me. She's like, you know, you're smart, you look great. And it's hard to see how this has negatively affected you.
Right. Well, that's just because you're resilient, right? Like,
exactly.
Some of us have different ways of coping with things and traumas, and this could be a trauma for you, or, you know, so, you know, you're just a resilient woman. So
thank you. And, you know, that's something that I've had friends tell me, you know, Katie, you're very strong. I just see you and I see strength in you. And I think that is something we get from our father. Mm-hmm. You know, he's dealt with a lot in his life. His dad died at a young age. And to that story, I've met my biological father. Uh-huh. And
Do you call, so not to get technical, but
yeah,
do you call your biological father, is that your father now?
I call him my father. Okay. I call Bill dad when we're on family situations. Sometimes I call him Bill dad. If I'm feeling like my conscience is weird about it, then I, you know, I try to listen to my conscience now. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky kind of still trying to respect him as a man and as my mom's husband and as someone who obviously played a big role in forming my life,
because sure. Right.
But also maintaining my own dignity and knowing that my father is out there and, like, that's who I'm like, you know?
Yeah. Do you find yourself resembling your biological father?
Oh yeah. I mean, like, personality, I look just like him. When I first saw the photo of him, I just cried. Like, Matt hadn't even gotten a DNA test yet, but I could tell, like, I looked just like him.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about finding your biological father?
Matt found him.
Okay. So did you know, prior to your conversation with your parents, did you know that Matt was on the hunt for him mm-hmm. and that he had found him?
No, he didn't find him for...
Two years.
Yeah. He found him 2 years after he found out.
Okay. That's what I meant. That he had found out that he was.
And yeah. So they told me, you know, Matt knows when they told me.
Gotcha.
He said, Matt knows. So I went outside and called him and we just kind of cried on the phone together. Mm-hmm. And it actually caused a wedge between us because I just didn't know how to process it. Partially because my friends didn't know what to do with this information. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to my friend's house. Her mom tells me I'm very loved. I go to my apartment in Gainesville and my friend doesn't understand why I'm crying about this because she likes my dad who raised me. You know, she doesn't get why it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And so I just had a lot of like lack of empathy, trying to understand, but not getting it.
Yeah.
And finally, my roommate, who was the same friend, said, you know, Katie, I was thinking about it and I was putting myself in your shoes, thinking about, you know, what if my dad sat down and told me that he wasn't my real father? And that would really affect me. She's like, it would be different. It wouldn't be the same kind of relationship. And so she really tried to understand. And I think over the years, as I've kind of, especially as I've been fulfilled getting to know my real father, my natural father, it's been easier to, well, for one thing, it's practically easier to think about these things because I have him to call if I need comfort. And I have him to call if I'm uncomfortable in my family I grew up with. You know, sometimes I just call him after seeing them because I need to remember that he's real. Mm-hmm. And I just need to talk to him. And it's as soon as I talk to him, like I feel so much better. And there are just these ways that knowing him are fulfilling. And I think before I met him, I could speak to what I felt like I was lacking. And, you know, there was, I really wanted to meet him before I got married and I didn't even think that would be a possibility. And then it happened. Like I met him in October and my husband proposed 3 weeks later.
Oh, wow.
Then he could tell that I was, he's like, you just seemed really happy. And I felt like you're ready to get married, you know, because I'd had these struggles and self-esteem struggles and, you know, fears of abandonment. And he like worked through those with me, but ultimately meeting my father really helped me cope with those. And they still do. Yeah. And still like talking to him is just so life-giving to me.
That's good. Yeah. Tell us about the first time that you met him. Was he excited to meet? Did you and Matt meet him at the same time? Or did you meet him later? Was he excited? Tell us about that moment.
Yeah, Matt and his family drove out to Kansas City to meet him, and I flew out there the next day. So Matt met him the night before. And I was an emotional wreck leading up to that. And, you know, I just had all this angst, you know, what's it going to be like. But as soon as I got off the plane and saw Matt, he was so happy. And we both just started crying.
And, like a long lost family member, really. I mean, that's just.
Yeah. He said, Katie, it's amazing. And so we went later that day, I think, to Kip's house. Kip is my father. And he opens the door and he just looks like a dad. You know, he's got the dad belly, got the balding head.
All the dad jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He just looked like a dad. I was like, yeah, I gave him a hug. And talking with him was just really natural. We talked for 3 hours at a restaurant.
Wow.
And he, you know, he like nudged my brother and gave him a hard time about things. And, you know, he's just, making up for lost time.
Yeah. Do you and Matt have any other half siblings that you're aware of or that you've met or?
Yes. So actually this week, a half sister has come up and these are some weird things you can't make up. So she was on 23andMe and that's how she found out she's donor conceived. It sounds like.
Okay.
She got a DNA test. And so she's kind of processing all of this. I haven't even talked to her yet, but she and I share a birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not the same year, but the same day.
Wow.
And another half sibling, the only other one that's come up, Blake, has the exact same birthday as Matt.
Wow.
Like same year, same day. And Blake was even 2 months early. Like he was premature. So
that's wild.
Yeah. It's been fun to get to know Blake. I don't see him a lot, but he's actually only 2 hours from me. He ended up being in Florida too. So we've all had to hang out. And I don't know much about our sister yet, but I was really happy to finally have a sister because I've only had brothers my whole life. Like finally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you really hit kind of the nail on the head when you were talking earlier about how people who haven't gone through this, just like people who haven't gone through infertility, don't understand the pain and the trauma and the desperation. And, you know, I've had in the work that I do, I've had people tell me, well, donor conceived people or people who are born from surrogacy or IVF, you know, they're happy to be alive. They wouldn't be alive if they, you know, these technologies didn't exist. Do you ever have people say that to you? And what's your kind of response to them?
Yes. Yeah, I've been told I need to be grateful for being alive. I mean, that's such a, there's no other way to put it than they're just not recognizing how I feel. You know, it's so demeaning to say that. You should be grateful. obviously, I love my life, but there's ethical ways to do things. And we can't treat people like products. You can't do that, you know. Everyone makes a big deal about slavery and how we were buying and selling people. And babies are no different, you know? So I think, what do I say that to that? I think now, it took me a while to kind of formulate language around that. Yeah, I think it's that, forgive me. I'm like blanking on.
That's okay. It's kind of, I'm putting you on the spot here. It's okay.
Yeah, no, but I think that's a good question. And I wrote an article on this, which is why I'm trying to rack my brain for the language that I put in that. But it's basically.
And you know, if you send me that article, I would love to include it as a link for our listeners to be able to go.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah, after just send me it and I'll be sure to include it for our listeners.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no, of course. It's no need to reinvent the wheel. And
well, I think to that question, I would say it, like, of course, adults don't have a right to a child. Children are a gift. And the way that we bring them into the world matters. And even though it brought me into the world, it doesn't mean we should keep doing it. You know, that doesn't mean it's okay and that we should keep creating people this way, because it's not good. It's not fair to those children to not know their mother or father. We know that adoption is painful. I think people seem to forget that because everyone, you know, even on my newsfeed, I have a friend who just adopted a little girl, and it's the, like, it's a good situation for this girl to be adopted. I think her parents couldn't afford her medical costs, and my friends could, and they met with the family for like 2 weeks. Like, they're in contact, you know. It's kind of like the best situation that adoption could be happening, because that little girl might even know her birth family. Mm-hmm. But kind of, you know, everyone on my newsfeed is celebrating this as if it's 100% good. But the reality is, this little girl won't be raised by her mom. And it's hard for me to celebrate that.
Yeah. I understand how you feel that way. My husband and I are foster parents, and we don't have a little one with us, but we did recently. And the day that his parents lost their parental rights, I was an emotional wreck all day, because it was, yes, he's safe now and he has a bright future, but it's just that separation of his parents from him, just legally, you know, he still gets a relationship with them. But people don't understand, I don't think, unless you kind of are in this world a little bit, and you especially being donor conceived, how important, and studies have shown this, how important our family history and our biology, that matters. Mm-hmm. And it affects us very deeply. Yeah. So I can a very, very small amount understand what you're feeling right now, but in a different way.
And I have a friend whose mom apparently would get in arguments with priests about this, Catholic priests, because she gave up her child for adoption in college, and they ended up meeting when the girl turned 18, and she regrets giving her up for adoption. And now they have a great relationship, and she's just brought her into her family, you know. I think it's a little awkward for her adoptive parents who raised her, but, you know, they, like, I think, like, encouraging child abandonment is partially the fault of all this positivity around adoption. when, sure, it's not convenient that she got pregnant in college, but looking back, you know, like she wished she kept her baby because it's mm-hmm. her baby. Mm-hmm.
So do you feel, I feel like sometimes when I hear cases of, you know, third party reproduction kind of gone wrong where someone didn't get what they purchased and so they abandoned the child, we're kind of creating orphans, so to speak, yeah. in this industry, whereas adoption is very different, which we don't have to go into that. But, you know, I feel like sometimes this industry creates orphans and that's not.
It does. Yeah. And I'm like a half orphan, right? Because mm-hmm. It was intentional. So I'm still with my mom, but I feel so bad for donor conceived kids who aren't related to either person raising them. Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to parents of donor conceived children, as far as say they have a young child and they have, are you all about like full disclosure as soon as possible? Or like, what would you say if we have a listener who has a, you know, a child from donor conception and this child is still pretty young, would you offer any advice to those parents as far as to help?
Yeah, I would say to disclose when they're young. You know, my half brother Blake, his mom did that, and I just credit her a lot with in kind of including him in it and not lying to him. And I think it's very important to just be honest with your child. I understand why some parents who are raising donor conceived children don't want to on a variety of levels. I think there's a lot of shame for the man who can't, you know, impregnate his wife. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really big deal for a man. And there's a lot of shame in that. And it's not something society's put on him. It's just that it feels, you know, I'm sure women feel like this when they can't conceive a child, this sense of shame or, you know, like your body not doing what it's made to do. That must be so frustrating. I forgot your original question. Were you saying creating orphans?
Well, and what would you say to parents who have already gone down this road?
Yes. Just to be honest and gentle. And I think helpful too in trying to introduce your child to their natural family, you know, as much as you can. I have a friend whose mom went all out after their relationship was pretty rocky from her being donor conceived, and she's known her whole life, but you know, her and her mom just had some like fallings out over it. Mm-hmm. And then her mom came back around and was DNA testing and researching and trying to find this girl's father. And I think it brought them closer together. And I think she did in the end find him. I don't know if she's talked to him at all or mm-hmm. how that's gone, but it really healed their relationship to have that kind of support from her mom. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is your kids do need to know their natural family, even if they haven't like, or they at least need your support to be open to that. You know, some kids say, the person abandoned me. I want nothing to do with them, you know? Sure. And that's their way of coping with it. So like some kids probably won't want to find them. But there's also a fear that you're going to hurt the people who raised you. And that's a real fear. Mm-hmm. And I think that creates kind of like barriers in your relationship with your kids if they're afraid to share this desire with you because they're afraid it's going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. So just making it clear and being that you're open to helping and open to meeting siblings, open to meeting the father or the mother, you know, whatever. Knowing that maybe like, I don't know how to speak to this necessarily, but speaking against that the child is a product. I met someone who said, no, my mom loved me. She picked me out of a magazine. And this person got really upset when I was trying to bond with her over donor conception because I had painted it as something that is painful. And she got very defensive and very upset. And she said, my mom picked me out of a magazine. And to me, that's not a compliment. That's like, right. When I saw blue eyes on the chart for what they were looking for a sperm donor for my mom, Like, I felt so gross about myself. And so somehow speaking against this language, just like treating your child with the dignity that they have, because they weren't necessarily given that at their conception. And so they still, they have that human dignity, but they might not be able to fully realize it because of the way that they're conceived.
Because, you know, in sperm and egg donation, right, they, you know, you kind of catalog through people and you pick someone that may resemble your bill, right? And, or, you know, or you might want, you know, there's recently in the news, just the Japanese woman that used a sperm donor, but then found out that he had lied about his education and his origins. And so now she gave the baby up for adoption. And I was just like, oh my gosh, if this isn't like, I was so frustrated. I was like, if this isn't like making a child a commodity, I don't know what else is.
Literally created an orphan.
But
it's her own child too, right?
What?
It's her own child.
Yeah. So let's shift a little bit to your advocacy work and your work with restorative reproductive medicine. That's something that if our listeners listen to season one, they're a little bit familiar with, but can you talk about what that is and your work there?
Yes. Yeah, so restorative reproductive medicine is just what it sounds like. It's restoring reproductive health because, you know, infertility is usually the result of something not going right in the reproductive system for whatever reason. Sometimes it's hormones, sometimes it's your thyroid or vitamin D deficiency. Sure, sometimes it's endometriosis, which is very serious, but there's also some more basic issues that could be going on, underlying issues. I had one nurse when I was working as secretariat for the International Institute for Restorative Reproductive Medicine, very long title, great group of doctors and healthcare practitioners and nurses who work on finding natural solutions to fertility issues. And this nurse just told her patients to reduce light in their room at night. And a substantial number of her patients became pregnant when they made that small change, because we produce progesterone at night. And if there's light pollution in your room, it might affect your hormone development. So I learned a lot working for this organization, but there's stuff like that, that they're just doing a lot of research, working with their patients to try to heal their infertility naturally. And, you know, if those hormone imbalances continue, you're not as healthy of a person. So it's really treating the whole person. It's not just treating the fact that they don't have a baby. And so because of that too, insurance is more likely to cover these treatments, because it's not just, you know, IVF, which is not a treatment. It's circumventing the reproductive system and how it naturally works and creating a baby in a lab. And that's very costly, and it's not healing anything. So something like restorative reproductive medicine, you know, if you have surgery because you have endometriosis and you need it removed, that might be covered. Because that's not necessarily, it's like, it's actually healing your body of something that's causing issues. It's not just circumventing it. It's not treating the child like a product, you know?
Right. So I feel like this is kind of a newer, and maybe it's not, and I just haven't heard of it, but I feel like women and men aren't made known about, like, media maybe, or I don't know who, but it seems like the push is very much for fertility treatment rather than restorative medicine. I don't understand why that is. Or is this fairly new?
It's the big fertility. IVF makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very expensive versus my NFP practitioner, because natural family planning is part of restorative reproductive medicine. You learn your cycles, just charting. Sometimes you can see, the doctor can look at your chart where you label, you know, this day I had my period, it was heavy. This day it was medium. This day I had spotting. You can look at your, your cervical mucus signs. You can look at your temperature. There's various things. And these doctors can look at your chart, and sometimes they can tell off the bat what's wrong. Say, oh, you have brown spotting. That's low progesterone. So I'll give you a progesterone treatment, boom, you get pregnant and you don't miscarry because now you have progesterone. And I think in medical school, doctors aren't taught all of this. that's what it seems like based on my friends who are nurses. And I have one friend who's a doctor who went through medical school, and she, like, I don't think they talked about charting at all. Mm-hmm. I talked to her about when she ovulated, and she texted me, "I'm ovulating," you know, like, that came from me, not from her med school.
Right.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
So I think they're not taught because there are these kind of other technologies that have happened. It's more lucrative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's outside of insurance, and it's not actually more successful than restorative reproductive medicine. IVF has a huge failure rate.
Right. Which isn't really disclosed. I read Miriam Zoll's book, and that was really eye-opening to me as far as just how manipulative and those numbers can be when you kind of shop around. So did your interest in restorative reproductive medicine come from your history with being donor conceived, or was this just you were happened to be interested in this as well?
I think that was mostly my history. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I had interviewed for that job, Dr. Tracy Purnell, who interviewed me, said, you know, I was telling her my story. At that point, I hadn't met my father, but my brother had found this video of him from a documentary from the 90s. And where the media was like tailing him, and it's a really awkward video, but she saw that when it aired in the 90s and she prayed for that man's children.
Oh my goodness. And then, here you are in her office interviewing. Holy cow. Wow.
Yeah. You can't make this stuff up. No. It's amazing. So it was partly this, my own history and experience with donor conception. Mm-hmm. That really fueled my interest. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, even in college, I was kind of against contraception. Just, I had, it's kind of personal, but like, I have really painful periods. Mm-hmm. And my roommate said, oh, just go on the pill, you know?
Right.
That'll help your period not be as painful. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, the pill is not a pain reliever. That's not going to fix whatever is going on. And she had such a nonchalant view about this, but to me, I'm like, my fertility is healthy. It's not something that needs to be suppressed. I just, maybe something's going on that is making it painful, you know? And that's what restorative reproductive medicine does, is it looks at, you know, what's causing so much pain in your periods.
Mm-hmm. How wise of you to have that, even like, you know, that insight, because I do feel like, you know, most of, oh yeah, sign me up. I mean, there's that new documentary out, right, about the pill. Jennifer, we're on that. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, but yeah, it was kind of that culture of, oh, it like is a problem solver. And, but so how wise of you and, you know, astute to kind of question that and be like, well, no, let's see what there should be something like a root cause analysis here.
Right. And I did, to disclaim, I did end up becoming Catholic. And that was the thing that made me interested in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And then I found a lot of peace knowing that the church teaches about human dignity and that, you know, everyone is a son and daughter of God, no matter how you're created. And that was very healing for me as well. And there's, so when I was, you know, having this kind of faith transformation too, it was just very edifying to my dignity and to this upholding of these natural processes that we're not addressing or honoring in how we handle reproductive care today. And you see this too. I was listening to one of your recent episodes about C-sections. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a great interview. That I just want to like have coffee with that woman. She's so
amazing. Yeah, she's amazing. And I just love, it's so interesting. Yeah, she's an interesting human. I like chatting with her.
But you see this in even like childbirth, we're kind of getting away from and what's natural and good. But to speak on hopefulness too, I think like, the movement against hormonal contraception is growing. I think women are tired of being on hormones. They're tired of their IUDs causing miscarriages or hurting them. You know, there's a lot of kind of women stepping back and saying, what am I doing to my body? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's widespread enough, but I think the same's happening with, you know, birth, wanting natural childbirth. I'm impressed by another podcast I listened on your show, a surrogate who actually had a natural birth. I was like, what?
Not a C-section, not a planned C-section. Yeah. I think women and maybe men, I can't speak for them so much, but I feel like also we're just starting to talk more about our reproductive health. And like, that's why this show exists, is to kind of make it less taboo and let's have a hard conversation. Let's not just dance around it. And I think, you know, for so long, women who've struggled with infertility and, you know, they haven't had a place to feel heard, or, and people don't know how to even, you know, wrap their arms around them, so to speak, right? Like, it's just kind of this hush-hush thing. And I'm really hopeful that the future is better and that we're not afraid. And, you know, we're not afraid to talk about donor conception. We're not afraid to talk about infertility, and we can truly wrap our arms around all of these people so we can treat people with dignity and find real answers and have the hard conversations and fix it a little bit. So
yeah, it's almost like we pulled the cart before the horse, because birth control came out at the same time NFP came out as a viable option for spacing your children, and people just ran with it, you know? And then IVF came out and people ran with it. Mm-hmm. And now maybe we're just starting to step back and say, you know, how are we using these technologies? Are they good? Mm-hmm. I think the dangerous part is that donor conceived people aren't able to really form a cohesive group. I mean, there are groups of us trying to do activism, mm-hmm. but it's not like, you know, it's not like the feminist movement or Black Lives Matters or something like that. A lot of people don't even know they're donor conceived, right. And everyone handles it so differently and copes with it so differently, that it's hard to kind of formulate enough of a movement to make a real change. I'm really thankful for your show because as a single person who's just, you know, I have my story and I've learned to tell it so that I get the compassion that I'm looking for from the person, mm-hmm. so that they like fully understand. Mm-hmm. But when I was first sharing my story, I got the worst reactions, and I could see someone just totally shutting down, you mm-hmm. know, when people say that they should just be grateful to be alive, or that must mean I hate my parents who raised me, you know, when people say these things, it makes a difference to whoever's trying to share their grief. And so there's just not always like social space of understanding mm-hmm. for people who are donor conceived. And I think that's true for adoptees as well.
Yeah,
because of this kind of like positivity around adoption, where it's very confusing and therefore it's kind of hard to make any kind of like, especially when it comes to not just regulation, but I think it's easier to regulate. I think it's harder to change people's hearts and minds mm-hmm. because as a donor conceived person, you really have to have strength and perseverance and the emotional bandwidth to formulate your story in such a way that you'll find support. Mm-hmm. Outside of people like you who just know understand the situation, because most, you know, most people are like my friend's mom. They'll just say, oh, you're very loved. Mm-hmm. You know, doesn't matter how you came in here into the world, like you're here. That's all that matters.
Right.
So
it does. Yeah. I've spoken to a lot of people who are definitely for regulation. As long as it's regulated, then it's okay. And as long as, you know, in Australia, they did away with the anonymity of it, but you have to wait till you're 18, which in my mind, that's like, okay, well, that could be too late, depending yeah. on how old the donor is. And so what would you like to see changed in the world of egg and sperm donation? Or would you like to see it just kind of abolished and gotten rid of? Or
abolished, would you like? Yeah. I'm an absolutist. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
Should we just like regulate slavery?
Right.
That's good, right? We should just regulate it. No, you don't just regulate away human dignity. Gotcha. It would be better, you know, it would be better than where we're at, but in some ways that also justifies it as a good cause if the government's supporting it somehow. So I don't buy that. And I think I've also seen it kind of confuse people, where I've been to a donor conceived conference in New York and no one was willing to say that they didn't want it to happen, but they were also screaming about their suffering and crying in this conference. And these professors were kind of like, okay, we don't know what to do with this, you know? So you're calling for regulation, but you still have all this angst that would still be there, even if it was regulated. But I think, like, I think some people, especially at this conference, who wanted regulation, it's like they were a little bit afraid to go as too far, maybe because they know it's not going to happen, you know?
Don't want to get their hopes up.
Right.
It's also just really hard in this culture. I've talked to a lot of guests about cancel culture, and not that donor conceived people are being canceled, but it just is really hard to have a voice these days a little bit, you know, like to kind of go against the mainstream. So I think that can be risky to have such a, you know, opinion about something, but.
Well, and it gets into other topics, like some of these people identified as lesbian or, and then you're getting into, you know, the rights of same-sex attracted people. You know, how are they going to have kids if they can't use donor contraception? Sure. Like, well, that's not, they don't have a right to another person's children, you know? And that gets into other topics like that are very controversial. And I love Katie Faust's book actually on this, Them Before Us.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. And she just covers all the angles on this of, you know, we have to put children before us as adults. That's right. Our job as adults is to care for our children and watch over them and protect them because they're vulnerable. And she goes into all of this very well. And I think she kind of covers a lot of different people's concerns with surrogacy and other practices. But
yeah, that's a great book. So before we end, where is a place that our listeners can find out more about restorative reproductive medicine, or maybe they can find out more about the donor conception world, or maybe they are finding out their donor conceived and they need to get plugged in? Do you have any kind of quick resources that we can let our listeners know about?
Yeah, so I think for restorative reproductive medicine, it's IIRRM.org.
Okay.
That is the place that I was secretary at for. That's really good for medical professionals, or if you are a lay person like me who's not trained and you just want to learn more. It's really cool to see these doctors present on the studies they're doing with their patients and the results that they're getting for various things. You know, they address PCOS, endometriosis, hormone imbalances, like very specific surgeries for very specific things. So it gets kind of technical, but I learned a lot just working with them.
Okay.
They are also an NFP conglomerate group. So there's doctors representing different natural family planning methods. And so you get kind of a picture of the various methods. And that's something, natural family planning has various methods for spacing your children or trying to conceive or trying to avoid children. And the different methods work for different people, you know? Mm-hmm. So you could look up the Creighton model. That's also known as NAPRO technology. You could look up Billings. That's what I learned. It's very simple. So that's good for me because I'm very regular. And then there's other kinds like the Marquette method out of Marquette University uses a little machine. And so it's a little more objective. So I have friends who really like that because it's not so dependent on your personal observations. And there's also, those are kind of the three at the top of my head. And then in terms of finding out your donor conceived, if you want empathy, go to anonymousus.org. That was started by Alana Newman, anonymousus.org. It's a very good website where you can post stories anonymously about your donor conception story. And just reading some of those, you know, grieving stories from people is kind of comforting because, you know, you're not alone.
Yeah.
There's another website. I haven't gotten very plugged in with them, but wearedonorconceived.com does some surveys. And then there's and they have a Facebook group too. I found their Facebook group to be kind of censoring. Okay. You know, it's kind of, if you're not like very progressive in your ideals, then you might get hushed or shamed. So I ended up leaving that group.
Okay.
And then my brother's networking website is donorchildren.org. And that's another good one for finding donor children in your area. He did a meetup when we were in Kansas City. So we got to meet a bunch of people who were donor conceived in the area. So it was really fun. So that's kind of the way that website is set up, is you put in your location, any information about your donor. And then there have been some really good stories actually on the New York Times. I'm not a huge fan of the Times because they just like, they have their problems, right? But they've done some, I think they've been editorials, a couple of stories from donor conceived people. One had photos of all his half siblings that he's met. And that was really powerful because you could see they each shared a little bit about their experience with it. And there was also another one that came out recently, but I don't remember the details. But if you look through donor children on New York Times or maybe some other newspapers, you might find stories that are encouraging.
Yeah. And then also we'll include a link to your article that you spoke about earlier in the show so that people can read that as well. So.
And I'm also happy to speak with anyone. So my email is ke.francisco@yahoo.com.
Okay.
If you've never talked to anyone else who's donor conceived or you just want to learn more, I'm happy to connect with you on it. I think finding community and finding other people is really helpful. The first time I met Alana Newman, she was the only other donor conceived people person I had met besides my brother. And just hearing her say, "The way we were conceived was huge." I started crying. Like, I'm not alone. Very isolating. So don't be lonely. You're not alone.
That's very generous of you. And thank you for that. Well, Katie, it has been an absolute privilege to have you on the show. And I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to chat with me and to share your story. I think our listeners are going to enjoy hearing from you. And I hope that if there's anyone out there that is donor conceived, that they're encouraged by your story. And I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in today. Our goal, as ever, is to create conversation, to facilitate discussion, encourage everyone to think beyond the masses. So again, thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you, Callie. It was great to meet you.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.